From PCJ Radio, this is Focus Asia Pacific. I'm Keith Parent. Coming up today, Pakistan promises to crack down on Taliban activity. They have said this before, but will they take action this time? In Indonesia, there have been calls for many to make easier working conditions during the holy month of Ramadan. And staying in Indonesia, we're going to look at journalist and self-censorship in the country. This is Focus Asia Pacific, putting the focus on the Asia Pacific. Pakistan has once again promised the United States it will crack down on the Taliban operating in the tribal area near the Afghan border. Pakistan's military chief, General Ashif Perez Kayani, outlined the planned operation to the top American commander in Afghanistan, General John Allen. The promise appears to be part of a strategy by Pakistan to deal itself into the final negotiations on who will rule Afghanistan after the international troops pull out in 2014. Bill Bainbridge has the story.
It's not the first time Pakistan has promised to launch combat operations against Taliban militants, and when US Defense Secretary Leon Panetta mentioned it during an interview in Washington, he only sounded vaguely certain that it would go ahead.
They've talked about it for a long time. Frankly, I'd lost hope that they were going to do anything about it, but it does appear that they, in fact, are going to take that step.
But if they do take that step, it may well be soon.
General Kayani did indicate that they had developed plans to go into Waziristan, and our understanding is that hopefully they're going to take that step in the near future. I can't tell you when, but the indication we have is that they're prepared to conduct that operation soon.
But Pakistan observers are taking a "we'll believe it when we see it" approach.
It's one thing for these announcements to be made. It's another thing for us to see some action on the ground.
Samina Ahmed is the South Asia Director for the International Crisis Group based in Islamabad. She says the promised assaults are part of Pakistan living up to its end of the bargain in order to push ahead with the normalization of military-to-military relations with the United States. But she adds,
that doesn't still explain why insurgent groups were allowed to operate all these years from safe havens in these territories, nor does it explain the fact that these operations, even the most recent ones, have proved so ineffective.
She says this time around, Pakistan's military may be more prepared to carry out their promise, given the deadline for withdrawal of international troops from Afghanistan is fast approaching.
It's going to be an ongoing bargaining process till 2014, with the Pakistani military wanting a quid pro quo in the context of any settlement reached in Afghanistan. So it isn't a one-way street here that the Pakistani military will make concessions and in the hopes that the relationship will be normalized. The Pakistani military clearly expects something in return.
The Taliban suspended reconciliation talks in March after accusing US officials of failing to honour confidence-building promises. The US ambassador to Afghanistan, James Cunningham, says he sees a role for Pakistan in reigniting those talks.
We want to see Pakistan play a positive, cooperative role in this across the board. I'm not going to get into specifics of things that they might do, but we've had, we and our Afghan, the Afghans who are in the lead in this, have had a thorough discussion with them, which is continuing, about things that they can do to promote the process.
Afghan officials revealed this week that they'd held secret talks with the Taliban's former second-in-command, who's in detention in Pakistan, in a move which could help rekindle negotiations aimed at ending the 11-year Afghan war. But Samina Ahmed is skeptical about those talks and says the external powers, including Afghanistan and the United States, will have little hope of bringing about reconciliation without stronger commitment from all the players within Afghanistan.
The only successful settlement in Afghanistan and the only sustainable settlement is going to be between the political opposition in Afghanistan and the armed opposition. No external actor can play a constructive role unless there is an internal process, a serious internal process of reconciliation, and we don't see that happening.
That was Bill Bainbridge reporting. In the world's most populous Muslim nation, millions of Indonesians are observing the holy month of Ramadan by fasting. But for many Muslims across the country, there is a fine line between earning a living and staying true to the sacred tradition. Askar Surabati has the story.
At the Tanah Abang textile market in the capital, Jakarta, business is booming ahead of their Eid al-Fitr holiday at the end of Ramadan. Hundreds of porters shift their heavy loads of clothing, and despite the back-breaking work, many are committed to fasting from dawn till dusk.
Nobody is telling me whether I should be fasting or not. It's up to me to carry on fasting. Even my boss does not tell me what to do.
Buyers and sellers come from all over Indonesia to trade here, and while religious traditions are respected, business is business.
I don't care if the porters are fasting as long as they're committed to their work. I want to see them having energy even in the month of Ramadan.
Each year, millions of Indonesians try to balance the demands of working life with the daily fast. At this construction site, workers are finding it hard to go without food and water for the entire day.
Our foreman tells us that we should try to keep fasting, but my friends and I have tried and failed. This is really hard work and it requires a lot of energy, so it's impossible for me to fast.
Activists are calling on the government to enforce working conditions that will allow everyone to fast. But one Muslim scholar says there are other ways to show devotion during Ramadan.
Workers such as these working at construction sites need a lot of energy. While these people are capable of fasting, it's not possible for them to do so because it'll affect their physical stamina. So they can give to the poor instead.
Many scholars already say that children and the elderly can skip the annual fast. And now it seems some workers may also be allowed to join them.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio. Our email address is pcj@pcjmedia.com. You can also call the PCJ Answer Line.
Call the PCJ Answer Line at country code 44-20-3286-1399. That's country code 44-20-3286-1399. And leave your comments and questions. On shortwave, satellite, and the internet, this is PCJ Radio.
And by the way, if you do call the PCJ answer line, some of the messages will be used on the program. A new investigation into the Indonesian media suggests that even in an era of democracy, press freedom is still far from guaranteed. Dr. Ross Tapsell, who lectures at the Asian Studies Department of the Australian National University, has published a paper called Old Tricks in the New Era. He argues that self-censorship is still alive and well among Indonesian journalists. But he says what has changed is the driving force behind that self-censorship. Up next, Radio Australia's Richard Ewart speaks to Dr. Ross Tapsell and a former Indonesian journalist, Anyar Suryani.
Ross, perhaps if I can start with you. You're saying that self-censorship is still alive and well in the Indonesian media, particularly in the press. How would you characterise that self-censorship at the moment?
Yes, so my research comes from interviews with a lot of journalists over a six-month period in Indonesia last year. And from what the journalists told me, the greatest concern over their autonomy was that of ownership and media ownership. And other studies have supported this claim, saying that the biggest influence over what Indonesian journalists can write and what they cannot is actually that of ownership. So this is all important, I guess, for looking at how do we frame freedom of the press in Indonesia.
So, Arne, is that a model that you would recognise in your experience, particularly at the Jakarta Post?
Yeah, basically when I was working for the Jakarta Post as a journalist, we are socialised that as a journalist, we have a freedom of expressions, but we have also have responsibility. I mean, when we write piece of articles, and then we also need to take into considerations regarding the impact of our writings. That's at times spark self-censorship among our journalists. But we need also to understand that actually the ideals or the visions of newspapers or media outlets also shape self-censorship among journalists themselves. So basically the journalists, they will tend to follow the visions and missions of the news outlets they are working for.
So did you, when you were writing as a journalist for the Jakarta Postman, did you feel comfortable with that? Did you feel it was the right thing to do?
I was very lucky because actually the Jakarta Post has the same vision and mission with me. I mean, I always respect meritocracy. I respect democracy and pluralism. So I'm happy to do it. But for some people who are having a different background with me, perhaps they are coming from hardline religious background, for example, so perhaps they are not happy in doing it.
So if I could bring Ross back in at this point, I mean, based on what Arne has had to say there, I mean, does self-censorship necessarily mean that the truth is not coming out, if you like? Perhaps it's just a more guarded way of getting news out there in a country where there are certain sensitivities to be considered.
Yes, so I think the key factor in the self-censorship is what drives it, and if what drives it is a kind of media ethics, then that's very much understandable. In this new argument that I've put in Old Tricks in a New Era, I'm arguing that we're seeing an increasing trend of prominent politicians and businessmen in Indonesia who are owning media companies and forming alliances. And so now, 10 years on after kind of the initial explosion of print media outlets, we now have 12 media groups controlling nearly all of the Indonesian media. And that includes a lot of online news media, which is important to state. A lot of people think, oh, well, we've got the internet, therefore, there's great freedom of expression there. So these controls, I suppose, or these conglomeration of media owners, therefore means that there's more likelihood that self-censorship is going to be driven as a practice in journalism by the ideals of the media owners. Arne is lucky in the Jakarta Post in that they don't have an overarching media owner. But in other companies, they can be owned by prominent politicians, including owners, including political party leaders, or businessmen.
So have you come across examples where journalists have been pressured by media owners to... So in other words, it's not self-censorship, that they've actually been told to change their articles?
Yes, there are a number of examples where you could really look into the details of how... I mean, it's not as if a journalist would be told directly, rung up by, a prominent Indonesian politician. Journalists don't work with owners in a direct sense. But it's more how the system operates. And what happens often, and in one case in Surabaya, when the newspaper was taken over by Golkar chairman Abu Rizal Bakri, we saw that the Surabaya Post, the newspaper there, couldn't write openly about the mud flow which was occurring on the outskirts of Surabaya, because Bakri also was involved in the Lapindo Bakri Brothers group, which was involved in that mud flow. So that's just one specific example where if the politician takes over the newspaper, or a prominent politician owns the newspaper, that would automatically affect how journalists feel that they can write on certain issues which affect that owner.
I mean, you've risen up the ranks at the Jakarta Post. You've held a managerial role there as well. You've heard Ross suggest perhaps that life is a little different at the Jakarta Post to maybe some other Indonesian publications. But how much influence can you, in a managerial role, bring to bear on the owners of the Jakarta Post? Do you have a good relationship with them?
So basically we are very lucky because the Jakarta Post consists of different owners. I mean, there is no majority of owners in our newspaper. So, and then also the owners... they also came from a journalism background. So basically they understand that it is very important for the owners not to interfere into journalism practices, because if the owners, they interfere too much to journalism practices, and then people will be going to lose their faith to the newspaper. Like, for example, if the newspaper owner, they shape very much the publications of certain articles, and then people are going to lose trust regarding the newspaper, and then certainly that the newspaper will go bankrupt if they fail to win the trust of the people.
So do you see your role at the Jakarta Post and that of your colleagues on the newspaper as filling the gaps, as it were? I mean, you heard Ross there talk about the example of the mud flow and what could and couldn't be said in certain publications. Presumably in the Jakarta Post that wasn't a problem for you.
There is no problem for us because we are guaranteed by the laws and regulations in Indonesia, and Indonesia is now a free country.
Now, Ross, I'm interested in what the dangers are of failing to self-censor. I mean, if a journalist, as it were, defies not a direct decision, because as you pointed out, there's maybe not a direct connection between the owners of publications and the journalists themselves. But if a journalist is sitting there thinking, well, if I write this and it goes to press, you know, I'm taking a risk, I mean, what can happen to them?
Yes, there are a number of examples of journalists having been moved from certain desks, and this doesn't just occur, I suppose, because of influence on media owners, but we've seen this throughout Asia. If a journalist writes something that, say, the government cracks down on in other countries, that might be the case. But where journalists are moved from, say, the political desk to suddenly be covering sports or fashion, or alternatively, they're moved to the night editor shift. That's a common kind of you're in the bad seat if you move to, you know, the 5 a.m. shift or 2 a.m. to 5 a.m. or something as an editor. But there are a lot of examples where journalists would tell me that they would write stories and they would just look at the newspaper the next day and it would be changed. And they would explain that the real story didn't come out because editors were tentative to really comment openly about the business interests or political interests of the owner in a negative or controversial light. So we did have many cases of journalists who would quit their publication and say, I don't want to write under these conditions. But of course, you know, they've still got to find another job. And as I said, there's really 12 media groups that are owning and controlling the Indonesian media. So it's difficult to then say, well, I'm going to work for another news agency.
On that point, Arne, I mean, do you consider that there are enough journalists in Indonesia who would be brave enough to take the system on, as it were? Or, as Ross rightly points out, do they have to look after their own interests and make sure they stay in work?
I think so far, like, the power of owners are very huge. So in other publications, people will be reluctant to take risks because it is a concern with their life and also their family living as well. So basically the influence of capital here is quite huge in the Indonesian publications. Yeah. Because people, they don't consider regarding themselves, but they have to take into account as well the living of their family.
And in terms of the way the press as a whole operates, do you consider that the press in Indonesia is in a reasonably healthy state, even allowing for this undercurrent of self-censorship?
Yeah, so the recent press freedom rankings of Freedom House, Freedom of the Press, has Indonesia ranked 97th out of 197 countries. Now, that's the 2012 rankings. Now, that's actually better than it has been for the past 10 years. Indonesia is usually ranked in about the hundreds, 140, I think, is out of 190 is as bad as the rankings have been. So over that past 10 years. So it does make you question, I suppose, you know, how free is this press? I mean, the Freedom House rankings, of course, are always somewhat problematic. In that, you know, rankings are naturally, you know, problematic in that way. But it does throw into caution the idea of the complete free press that occurs in Indonesia after democracy, which did occur, particularly after 1998, when there were 1,200 new print media and more than 900 new commercial media licenses awarded in a four-year period after Reformasi. And now we've seen that increasing conglomerisation of the Indian and cartelisation, I guess, as one Indonesian observer has called it. So the recent title of that Freedom House report was that the party's over for openness and that more restrictions are expected of the Indonesian press and Indonesian media. So, you know, we're watching closely and hoping that that's not the case.
Arne, I mean, what do you think it will take to change the situation to make it easier for journalists to essentially write what they want to write?
The health of the media operation is very important. And if the company is healthy, and then perhaps the company and also journalists, they can look forward to improve the independence of the media. But the problem is, like in other parts of Indonesia, and the media companies, they rely on advertising. They have to struggle to survive. Then when it comes into that problem, and the media independence is at risk.
Can I suggest to you, Ross, that whilst the focus here, obviously, and on your work is on Indonesia, perhaps there is an assumption that this kind of self-censorship going on in the media only happens in a country like Indonesia, couldn't possibly happen in a country like Australia. But isn't the reality that perhaps the media ownership means that Australia is moving towards the situation in Indonesia?
Oh, exactly, a very good point. And certainly media ownership and the consequences of it are not limited to Indonesia, both in Asia and in Australia, of course, with the issues of the Murdoch press and recently Gina Rinehart. And the role of, I guess, mining magnates now involved in the media in Australia is actually quite similar when you look at someone, say, like Abu Rizal Bakri, who has interest in mining and a lot of other things, it being involved in the media. But certainly it's not just Indonesia, in Asia as well. I mean, the South Korea, research done in South Korea found that most journalists surveyed nominated media owners as the determinant most likely to influence press freedom. And certainly India has newspapers that are largely owned by business barons. Certainly don't want to suggest that this is limited to Indonesia, but this is an increasing trend. And it is interesting to think about, I guess, more broadly, is, you know, who's going to afford to own newspapers in the future with the declining circulation and, as Arne suggested, the health of or financial health of print media generally. So we kind of must wonder or ponder that in the future, perhaps the only people who can really afford to own newspapers are going to be those with vested interests or those with who make money out of something else and then are using the media to further their interests. Perhaps that is the future of the print media in the Asia Pacific.
So with the internet and news coverage on the internet growing ever larger, presumably that the role, particularly, for example, of the bloggers becomes ever more important, because you would assume that in most, if not all cases, they will write what they want to write and nobody's going to stop them. And that's the way of perhaps plugging the gap that exists in the Indonesian press.
Really interesting point. The future of this is certainly not clear. I think it's important to include online media in some of this media ownership. For example, in Indonesia, Charul Tanjung, the owner of Trans TV and Trans Tuju television stations, bought an online news media, Detik.com, for $66 million Australian dollars. Detik.com is currently Indonesia's biggest online media site. So certainly we are seeing an increase into online news. And if you would talk to any of these media owners or media executives, they would say the future is with online news. And if you were just to scan news websites of either television news or newspaper websites, you would find that there's an increasing trend to try and link social media into these websites. And what we're seeing is a convergence of platforms. And so this does raise the question, though, does that give bloggers more autonomy or more ability to get their voice out in the mainstream media because it is now linked to mainstream media? Or does this mean that owners are trying and you know, media corporations are trying more thoroughly to incorporate these bloggers and these social media outlets into their message, and therefore there'll be less room for social media and independent bloggers to get their message out because they'll be all consumed by this media convergence. Really interesting to look at in the next few years.
Okay, final point to Arne, if I may. I mean, you began your career as a journalist back in November 1998, I believe, with a perspective.
Yep.
So
yep.
what are we now? I'm doing the quick maths here. 25 years nearly down the track. I mean, do you think that the press is better now, that it's freer now than it was when you started, or is it just different?
I think the press is more free right now, but the problem is still with the media ownership and also the healthy operations of the media. Like for example, the newspaper is still very influential in shaping public policy. But the problem with the newspaper right now is that we earn so little money from advertising. We have to migrate to online because this is the future of our newspaper publications. But the problem is when you are migrating into online, you are going to earn little money. While right now, the bulk of the money is mostly coming from print advertising. So basically, this is a big problem right now in Indonesia because the circulation of newspaper is stagnant.
Former Indonesian journalist Anyan Sudiani and Dr. Ross Tapsell, Asian Studies lecturer at the Australian National University, speaking with Radio Australia's Richard Ewart. And guess what? We are now officially out of time. If you wish to listen to this program again, as well as catch all past editions, go to our website, www.pcjmedia.com/FAP. Once again, www.pcjmedia.com/FAP. You can also contact us by email, which is pcj@pcjmedia.com, pcj@pcjmedia.com. Well, I have to leave you right now, but I'll be back in 7 days' time for another edition of Focus Asia Pacific. Special thank you goes to Radio Australia. Until next time, friends, I'm Keith Pallon wishing you well. Take care. Bye-bye.
This is PCJ Radio on 88.2 FM. This is PCJ Radio on 107.5 FM in Nairobi, Kenya. And nationwide on 5. This is PCJ Radio on KBCT in Waco, Texas. This is PCJ Radio on 9955 kHz to Latin America. This is PCJ Radio on 7590 kHz DRM. On shortwave, satellite, and the internet. This is PCJ Radio.